encouragement it is to be able to stand on something that's solid and sing about someone who is constant.
The only constant thing that you and I will ever see on earth is the eternal constancy of God.
Rest in the
perfect deity of Jesus of Nazareth, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever.
And the constancy of Him who is and who was and who is always
the same.
And some people don't know anything about the constancy that we understand and accept as a constant reference point for our lives. And it gives us the stability that we need. I'm glad to be back with you again tonight and continue our talking or our discussion together about the church. And a few weeks ago, we talked about the church in transition. Perhaps not in living memory has changed, peaceable change, in so many different places at almost the same time been ripped across the consciousness of the human race as it has in these last few weeks. The walls of political opposition, the walls of political alienation are coming down all over the Eastern Europe. It's happening in China. It's being threatened down in South Africa. All over this globe, change is fermenting and the winds of change are blowing. And it is about as futile to try to stop the winds of change as it is to stop the wind. The only thing you can do is to get your constant point of reference and let whatever will blow by and hang on for dear life and batten down the hatches, because change is on its way today, perhaps as we've never seen it in our memory. The resistance to change has finally gotten the message. It's over. Our resistance to human freedom, our resistance to information, our resistance to enlightenment, all of this, it's finished. It came down with the wall. And not that it's over, in the sense, because there'll be others who will establish yet other kingdoms who will try to resist yet other change. But for right now, there's not a one of us sitting here who, in your memory, can recall anything in the way of peaceful change that has been so dramatic, so far-reaching, so deep, and so thrilling as what we've been witnessing in the last few weeks. It was hard to keep back tears as we saw the people up on the wall of Berlin dancing and hugging, and it was a state of euphoria that probably the Eastern German people thought they would never experience, but they're experiencing. Lech Walesa today stood in a joint assembly of the House and Senate and was given a 7-minute standing ovation. They received him as a hero. Lech Walesa will go down in history as not just someone who learned to cope with change or someone who eventually came to be comfortable with change. Lech Walesa will stand out in history as being a human being who became a catalyst
for change. And I don't know how comfortable you are with being a catalyst for change, but may I remind you that that's our role as a Christian? We'll talk about it more toward the end of the lesson. But perhaps the next nearest example to peaceful change, the next nearest example of what we're witnessing right now, came 2,000 years ago when the followers of Jesus of Nazareth, the man we hold as Lord, the one we believe is the embodiment of God on earth, when his followers began to spread out all across the Roman Empire and began to effect change. They began to be catalysts for change. And it produced an absolute transition, or an absolute revolution. Peaceful though it was nevertheless a revolution of proportion that perhaps the world had never seen before. Religious traditions 1,000 years old were uprooted. Political stability that had been in place for 500 or 600 or 700 years began gradually to crumble, and new winds of change began to blow across it and to give people a sense of identity and a sense of purpose beyond this life, and a sense of worth and a sense of peace and a sense of joy and a sense of God's presence that the world never had known up to that point. The walls of religious ignorance and ethnic hostility began to fall before the standard of Jesus Christ. There was opposition. There was opposition coming to this change from two different directions. There was opposition on the part of the heathen people. They didn't like people invading their territory. They'd already had their places staked out. Their pews were already marked. And they didn't like anybody coming in and sitting on their pew. They wanted it to be their own. And so there was this enormous resistance to change, and it took shape in the form of persecution, and thousands upon thousands of Christian people were slaughtered like animals in order to try to stop this tide of change. But that wasn't all as far as the change or the resistance to change. There was a resistance to change also among the Jewish Christians. They also felt threatened by change. They felt threatened by the change, by the possibility. They felt threatened by the inevitability, it came to be viewed as, of the prospect of there being people who were following Jesus Christ who weren't very much like them at all. They didn't keep the Sabbath, and they didn't circumcise their children, and they didn't keep the holidays, and they didn't observe kosher food laws. And all of a sudden, there sprang up in the face of all these Jewish Christians who had been bound and comforted and cradled and sheltered by their own traditions for 1,400 years, traditions that had come about not only by accumulation, but some of them by revelation, to which these Jewish Christians were committed in a life and death struggle. They were not going to give them up. Only by the severest testing of God and by the most constant prodding of God did they finally throw up their hands and say, well, okay. And even then, there was a diehard, hardcore group that went to their grave defying the inevitable quality of change that is inherent within the kingdom of God. We call them the Judaizing teachers. We call them the Judaizing or the Jewish church that went to its grave resisting the change. We talked about that a few weeks ago. But they were threatened with this prospect. The only common denominator between the Jewish Christians and the Gentile hordes that were invading their territory or who were taking over the kingdom, and the Jew looked upon it as an absolute taking over the kingdom, and they warned in advance, if you don't circumcise them and make them keep the law of Moses, if you don't make them like we are, the kingdom's going to be gone. They warned in advance. But that's the only thing that was the common denominator between the Jew and Gentile Christian was this simple faith in Jesus Christ expressed in a simple act of baptism and stamped with a simple stamp of validity of the Spirit of the living God. Other than that, there were meat eaters, there were vegetarians, there were people observing holy days, there were people that weren't observing the holy days, and all this was thrown into one hopper, and the motor was turned on, they were all mixed up, and my goodness, what chaos there was in the minds of people who were intent on controlling everything and keeping it under wraps and refusing to let the Spirit of God be what it was that dictated the condition and of the church. But you know what? If the Jewish church had been listening, maybe that's why Jesus kept saying, are you listening? Be careful how you hear. If the Jewish church had been listening, they would have heard Jesus say loud and clear, there's going to be change on the way. You're not going to be able to maintain the status quo. The traditions that have been accumulated over the past are going to come to an end. If they had been listening to Jesus carefully, they would have heard him saying and pointing out loud and clear the coming of the very thing that they dreaded the most. And I'm not sure which it was that they dreaded the most, the thought and the prospect of change in themselves or the prospect of allowing change in other people that surrounded them. I'm not sure which we dread the more. And I mean by change in the other people, I'm talking about the allowing of the diversity that exists because of the fact that God did not create us as the epitome of human reality or of divine reality either. He didn't make us the center of the universe. He didn't make me the center of the universe. And the prospect of my changing as I grow nearer and nearer toward the truth or of allowing you the possibility of being different from me, I'm not sure which we dread the more. But if they had been listening to Jesus, he would have said that. Turn to your Bibles to Luke, the 5th chapter. This is one of the most outstanding examples of where Jesus is calling us to change. And you know, I'm talking tonight, I am getting older and older. I'm 56. Many of you are older than that. Older people are the ones most aware of change and the most resistant to it. Young people, they may be aware of it, but man, bring it on. They ain't got anything invested. And some of them change just for the sake of change. As you get older, you don't like change. And so it usually ends up as being the older generation with their heels dug in saying, you're not going to do this to me. We're not going to change. We're going to keep it just like it's been all of my life. And we talk about the good old days, the young people who don't have as much invested in tradition and don't have as much invested in time and in building and in history. They don't really fear change. Maybe that's why God put us all in the same church together, so we could benefit from each other. In this 5th chapter of Luke, beginning in verse 27, there's a passage from 27 on through the end of the chapter. There is a bookend. There's bookends. One of them is, these bookends are the context. The books that we're going to look at, they're the text.
But the book ends are verses 27 and 28, the call of Matthew Levi. After this, he went out and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax office, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he left everything and rose and followed him. I doubt that this was the first contact that Jesus has had with Matthew Levi. It doesn't say. But the man knew enough about Jesus to know that he was giving up a lucrative position, one with permanence, one with stability, one with security. He was giving up all that to follow a man, an itinerant preacher, who had virtually nothing. He knew enough about him. He wasn't a fool. He knew enough about him to know that he was making the proper decision. And it was a permanent transition or a permanent change. Matthew Levi is the one that wrote the book of Matthew. So it was a beneficial change, it was a permanent change, it was a drastic change, but Matthew Levi stands here as one of these bookends. Here is a living, breathing example of change. And we're thankful that that took place in his life. The other bookend is down in verse 39, where it just simply says, change, as far as it comes to people who are settled, change is not welcome. No one, after drinking old wine, desires new. For he says the old is good enough. And so he just simply points out a human characteristic that we don't like change. We would much prefer that it stay in the same rut. We would much prefer that we allow or be allowed to go on to our grave. And as Hezekiah stated toward the last of his life, when Isaiah came and said to him, the Assyrians are coming, but God has decided to wait and not bring it in your life. Hezekiah said to himself, he said, well, good, at least it'll be peace in my time. Hang the children, but at least there be peace in my time. And it just refers to the same resistance. No one, after drinking old wine, desires new, for he says the old is good enough. No one who sat in a pew desires to change. The old pew is good enough. And I keep on referring to the pew because you understand that. I know you do, because you're back where you were. So we're all right, but you understand the resistance that we have to change. If you hadn't, whenever you finally sucked it up about 3 or 4 months or two, a couple of months ago, and got up out of your seat, and contrary to everything that was in you, sat down in a brand new cold seat, you'd still be there. But after I left, you said, oh boy, and you went back. And like my little granddaughter, when they came back after about 3 weeks, when she was 2 years old, they moved us to Boston. She had been separated for a week in vacation, 2 weeks in Boston, a week coming back, about a month. And as they drove up the street toward her house, this little two-year-old said, my home, my home. 2 years old. Listen to what Jesus, though, calls us to. Here's an example of change. Here's an admission that nobody likes it. But listen to what he says. Verse 29, and Levi made him a great feast in his house, and there was a large company of tax collectors and others sitting at table with them. And the Pharisees and their scribes murmured against the disciples, saying, why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners? Jesus answered them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. You know what he's calling them and us to do here to change? He's calling upon us to change our way of looking at people. That was the problem with the Pharisees. They were looking at people wrong. When the physician came into the community and did not associate with those whom they considered to be well, which was themselves, when this great teacher came and the great physician came, and he went among the people who were sick, he went among the outcasts and the sinners, they became upset by his going out among the people who really needed the physician. They became upset with his being among the disreputables and the outcasts and the disenfranchised. And they said, why are you always eating with them? And Jesus just simply said, because of the fact that they're the ones that need the physician. Can't you see that, he would say? They're the sick people. Not that these other folks weren't, but they just didn't recognize it. So he said, I'm going to the ones who recognize that they're sick. And it's so easy for us to spend our lives just associating with people that you know. And you know how that's right. One of the things that's been a criticism of this great church over the years has always been, it's so hard to break into it. Well, it's because of the fact that we all have the people that we've been with for so long, and we like them, and we like to be around them, and we just don't like to get outside our comfort zone. That's not just you, it's me, and it's everybody else. But that's what Jesus had in mind in Luke the 14th chapter when he said, when you give a feast, he was at a man's house eating, and said he said to the man who had invited him, when you give a dinner or a banquet, don't invite your friends or your brothers or your kinsmen or rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, and you'll be blessed. Well, he was just simply saying, get outside your comfort zone. Change your way of looking at people. Realize that your mission in life is to be a catalyst for change. But you can't be a catalyst for change if you keep the salt in the shaker. He would use that expression. You can't be a catalyst for change if you're going to put your light under a what? Under a bushel. You can't be a catalyst for change if you're going to keep the yeast in the packet. So he says, get outside your comfort zone. You're not going to influence people. You're not going to be a catalyst for change unless you're able to change your way of looking at people. And I would just say that maybe what's happening to our outreach is that we have spent our time going to people who were so much like we are and had so little distance to change or to make, to cover in order to be like we are, that we never have really gotten out to the people who are in need. And I suspect that Jesus would say, if your way of looking at people does not meet the needs of people in need, then change your way of looking at people. I think that's what happened when you made when you built his house. I think that this church here, if you'll let me say this, this congregation is in as healthy a state of change. You're in a state of transition. From the time that I left here 9 years ago, you've made numerous changes. This is one example. There are people all over this city tonight sitting around talking about God and singing and praying together. You may not like that change. It may make you uncomfortable that there are only about a couple or so hundred here tonight. But look, there are about 25 of them in my house. They're all over this city. That's been a healthy change. It's just a change of the way that we're looking at things with people particularly. Well, anyway, that's the first thing. We're not going to have time to be in any detail. Secondly, when he answered that, and you know it did make sense, when he said it's the sick that need the physician, and you can just see them thinking, well, yeah, you know, okay, that does make sense, yeah. But then you can't answer some people. They said, yeah, but why are you always eating? You answered the question, why are you eating among sinners? But why are you always eating? The disciples of Moses and the disciples of the Pharisees, they all fast. But you're always eating. Why are you always eating? Oh, and Jesus said, how can you make the friends of a bridegroom fast while he's still with them? Oh, that makes sense, too. You see, it was their tradition to fast twice a week. Moses, as far as my understanding, required one fast, and that was just one a year. They required 104 fasts a year in order to be a good Jew. Moses required just one. Their traditions had begun to multiply and to become encrusted with such accumulation through time that they were fasting twice a week. And they asked Jesus, why aren't your disciples fasting? He said, how can they fast while the bridegroom is still with them? The time will come when they will fast, when he's taken away. What he's saying here is simply this, I think. You need to change your way of looking at traditions. You see, they were breaking the traditions of the elders by not fasting. Jesus is saying you need to change your way of looking at tradition. And here's the standard at which you're to go. If your traditions do no longer harmonize with reality, change your traditions. Well, that sounds good, but don't try it if they're my traditions. Stay out of my backyard. Don't mess with my traditions. Tradition never likes to be disturbed. Yours doesn't. Why are we like that? I don't know. We're creatures of habit. We don't like to be disturbed if our traditions don't like to be upset. In fact, I'm convinced that it was Jesus tampering with the Jewish traditions that did him in. Their traditional way of looking at God. Their traditional way of looking at people. Their traditional way of looking at the Sabbath. Their traditional way of looking at religion. Their traditional way, period. They just simply were not accustomed and were not ready for Jesus coming in and saying, look, you're going to have to change your way of looking at tradition. If your traditions no longer harmonize with reality, then change your traditions. He wasn't adverse to that. Even the great Sabbath. He said, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. I can do only what I think best. And he took them to task and said, for goodness sakes, stop judging by appearances and start judging right judgment. They were judging him and condemning him. And he said, if you only knew what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you wouldn't have condemned the guiltless. But they were doing it because they didn't have a proper view of tradition. If it doesn't harmonize with reality, for goodness sakes, he says, change it. There's a third reason, third thing that happens here. Look what he did in verse 36. He started telling them a parable. No one tears a piece from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. If he does, he will tear the new, and the piece from the new won't match the old. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the new wine will burst the skins and it will be spilled, and the skins will be destroyed. But new wine must be put into new wineskins or fresh wineskins. And in this particular few verses here, he's just simply saying, you're going to have to change your way of looking at change. Change is inevitable. And he says, if you're dealing with the new wine of the kingdom, it is inevitable and absolutely essential that you establish in yourself the needed flexibility to give and take with the flow of the wine and the power of it. Guess which one's going to win if they put new wine in the old wineskins? Well, both of them will lose because he said one will be destroyed and the other will be spilled. But I'll guarantee you, the wineskins won't contain the wine. The wine's going to burst the skin. And so he says here, you're going to have to change your way of looking at change. Jesus in these few verses is calling us to a perpetual state of flexibility. That's enough to give you high blood pressure just thinking about it. A perpetual state of flexibility, that's right. Are you prepared for that? Well, I guess I can cope with it. No, we're not asking you to cope with it. He's not calling us to cope with it. He's calling us to be a catalyst for it. You mean to tell me that the church of God on earth is supposed to be a constant state of flexibility? That's right. If it's going to be a church in transition, unless you're going to go back and say, I opt for being a Judaizing teacher, and we're going to keep things like they've been for the last 50 or 75 or 100 years, and that means everything intact right on down to the judgment, that's not the kingdom of God. That's a denomination. When you crystallize the thing, when your leaders fall and you crystallize it, much like the Lutherans did when Luther died, they raised the standard, crystallized the Lutheran doctrine, and went down in history as a denomination resisting change. And any time we talk about the restoration having already been accomplished and now we're just simply setting it in place, forget it. You never have been a part of that if you're in the kingdom. The kingdom isn't like that. Let me show you why. Turn over to Matthew the 13th chapter quickly as we close. Matthew 13 addresses this issue. And I mean he hits it head on. Verse 44, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field which a man found and covered up, and in his joy goes and sells all he has and buys that field. Watch the test. Watch his brain, the wheels of his brain just churning. He sees something here that's new to him. He's going to go, now he's deciding whether to go sell everything that he's familiar with, all of his treasures, all of his household goods, all of his land, everything that he's got, and he's going to buy this land here because of this treasure that's in it. And he finally says, I'm going to do it. And he covers it up real quick and he runs and sells it. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. On finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. All these pearls that he'd inherited from his daddy and his mama. They named them back there, and they could tell by the feel of them which one it was. Oh, that's old Joy, and this is old somebody else. And they knew them by name, and they felt so good. But he found this one of great price, and it made him decide something. Is this all worth giving up in order to have that? And he said, yeah, the idea is, I'm going to do it. So he went and sold all those pearls and bought this one of great price. Verse 47, again, the kingdom of heaven was like a net which was thrown into the sea, and it gathered fish of every kind. When it was full, men drew it ashore and sat down and sorted the good from the bad. This one goes and this one stays. This one goes. Listen to them as they make these decisions. What goes and what stays? And they had to make these decisions. At the end of this, Jesus says, have you understood these things I've been talking about? They said, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. They didn't understand. If they did, it's the first thing they understood that he ever told them. They were the hard-headedest bunch of people. They didn't understand. Well, they give them the benefit of the doubt. They said they did. Okay, we'll just let it stand there. But I don't think they did. The reason why I don't think they did, because later on, it was like pulling eye teeth to get Simon Peter to give up the traditions that Jesus got through talking about. He didn't understand. Okay, they said to him, yes, yeah, we understand. And he said to them, therefore, every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like a householder who brings out of his treasure what's new and what's old. But the key here is every scribe who's been trained for the kingdom of heaven. What are you being trained for? What are we being trained for in this movement of which we are part? Is it the kingdom of heaven? If so, he says you're going to find things in your treasure house or your treasure trove, new and old. They won't all be old. Because just because something's old doesn't make it truth. Nor will it all be new. Just because it's new doesn't make it heresy. But he says the person who's being trained for the kingdom of heaven is like a scribe, or is like a man that's brought out of his treasure things new and old. You see, Jesus is not just calling us to change. Jesus is calling us to truth. Jesus is calling us to truth. He's calling us to be searchers for truth. And may I say something? If we today escape becoming a full-fledged denomination, it will be the first time in human history when a restoration movement avoided that catastrophe. You know why? Because we're so insistent on holding to things which have become cultural baggage that we've accumulated over the years, we will absolutely split the body of Christ down the middle before we'll give up some preconceived ideas that are not biblical. I'm not saying that what you're holding on to is not biblical, but the ones that differ from you are not biblical. Isn't that right? The one cuppers and all that bunch, they'll split the kingdom over it. If we avoid becoming a sect and a denomination of full-fledged, it will be one of the first times in the history of the human race where a restoration movement or any other kind of a movement escaped it. You want to escape it? Would you like to go down in history and say, those people in the college church in Searcy led a movement that was in training for the kingdom of heaven, Now, if you're just interested in training for a denomination, let's just go on and never bring out anything new or old. But he says, if you're in training for the kingdom of heaven, you're going to be like somebody who is bringing out of his treasure what's new and what's old. So, he calls us here to a perpetual state of flexibility. Sure, it makes you nervous. Sure makes you nervous to be called to change. Sure makes you nervous to let other people around you be different from you. But you know what? I think we're going to have to make a decision whether we're going to sit in the seat of the Judaizing teacher and say, no, if you're going to be a Christian, you're going to be just like me. Or, if you're going to follow the Apostle Paul and let him say in the Roman letter, chapter 14, Jesus Christ is the judge, and let's pursue what makes for peace, and not everything pertains to the kingdom of God. He says simply this, open your hearts to what's good, open your hearts to the truth. He doesn't call us just to change. There's no real validity or no real worth in just changing to be changing. But when you and I stumble over truth, let's keep ourselves open to the windows and keep the windows of truth open to where when the winds of change start blowing and we start realizing, by the way, that's good, solid truth. But it's different from what you've been at. Oh, I know that. But I've learned, you know, I don't have a perfect possession of the truth. Neither do you. You don't understand the truth perfect. Isn't it exciting? And isn't it exciting? You may lynch me in tar and feather, but I don't think you will. You see, this is one reason. Isn't it exciting that we can stand here in this pulpit and call people to the eternal truth of the eternal, unchanging God and admit bold faith, we're open and ready. You lead and we'll follow. That is exciting. The walls are coming down. You know who are the people who are the most resistant to change? Oh, I don't know whether I know or not. I thought I would say that, but I don't know whether I know or not. I know that the more people are informed, the more they refuse to be shackled. I know that. But the people who are in control, in controlling positions, the older generation, whenever they come to know that where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is what? Tell you, there is freedom. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. Well, don't think that the people of East Germany are not nervous over what's happening. Don't think the people of West Germany aren't nervous. Don't think the ones that are leaving East Germany are not nervous. Change always makes you nervous. But where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. And I guarantee you, I don't want to go to my grave having perpetuated a denomination. What I long for with all that's in me is to be a person responsive to the Spirit of the living God, responsible to the Word of the living God, and just simply let it do with us what it will. One boy, a member of a very, very, very conservative church down in Bryan, Texas, where I went to College Station. He was in Bryan. He called me one time. He said, Brother Woodruff, I need to talk to you. I said, fine. So I went over to his house and sat down in his kitchen, and he looked at me and he said, if I stay where I am, I'm going to die. Spiritually, I cannot live. But he said, when I look at where you are, it scares me to death. Well, I laughed with him. I said, yeah, I can understand that. And it would scare me to death except for one solid, paramount truth that I have knowingly accepted for my life. I said, I have decided to hook my anchor in Jesus of Nazareth and let it lead me where it will. I couldn't care less, because He is the one only who is the same yesterday and today and forever. He's the only constant you'll ever know, except the constant change that you experience while you're here on earth. May God bless us. Thank you for thinking through these things with me. Remember, He calls you as light and salt and leaven. These are all instruments of change. All of them, salt, light, and leaven, are the three figures that Jesus used to describe your personality and your presence in the world. And every one of them are catalysts for change. Okay, may God bless us. Let's stand and sing this song together.